This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
More than two-thirds of all global refugees come from five countries. Syria tops the list, followed by Afghanistan, South Sudan, Myanmar, and Somalia.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details next. Also, South Sudan's political rivals, President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar, are to meet tomorrow in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. And because of the fighting between armed separatists and government troops, thousands of children in Cameroon's English-speaking regions have lost access to education. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the UN Refugee Agency reports the number of people forcibly displaced by wars, persecution, and general violence reached a record high of 68.5 million last year, most inside their own countries. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva. The UNHCR's Global Trends report on Forced Displacement 2017 finds refugees who sought protection in other countries accounted for 25.4 million of the total.
Last year's record number of forcibly displaced is nearly 3 million more than in 2016, making this the biggest increase in a single year. The UN Refugee Agency reports major crises accounting for this rise in numbers include the nearly 700,000 Rohingya refugees who fled into Bangladesh to escape violence in Myanmar, escalating conflicts in South Sudan and DR Congo, as well as deteriorating conditions in Venezuela. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi says 85% of the world's refugees are in mostly poor developing countries struggling to care for their own people.
It should be an element dispelling the perception, the notion that is so prevailing in many countries that the refugee crisis, singular, is a crisis of the rich world. It is not. It continues to be a crisis mostly of the poor world. So people from poor countries moving to poor countries or staying within their country but as displaced.
Data show more than two-thirds of all global refugees come from five countries. Syria tops the list, followed by Afghanistan, South Sudan, Myanmar, and Somalia. The report says Lebanon hosts the largest number of refugees relative to its national population. But for the fourth consecutive year, Turkey was home to the largest number of refugees worldwide, 3.5 million, mainly Syrians. The UNHCR notes a steep 40% decline in the number of refugees countries were willing to accept for resettlement last year. It finds most of the 1.7 million asylum claims were lodged in the United States, followed by Germany, Italy, and Turkey. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Ethiopia's foreign ministry today confirmed that South Sudan's political rivals, President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar, are to meet tomorrow. The rivalry between the two men led to a civil war that has dragged on more than 4 years. Pressure is growing on the two sides to agree on a transitional government. The Regional Intergovernmental Authority on Development pushed them to meet before the African Union summit on July 1st, and the United Nations threatens to impose sanctions on South Sudan leaders if they do not reach a peace settlement. However, South Sudan Opposition Alliance spokesman Kwaji Lasu says the latest IGAD proposal gives President Kiir more power than the other warring parties. Lasu says the opposition will not sign such a deal. The The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission has so far withheld the official voters' roll from most parties, a move that has raised concern over the body's ability to run credible elections next month. The country's main opposition has said Zimbabwe should not hold the election if the commission does not show impartiality. Sebastian Mumfu reports from Harare.
Last week, some Zimbabwe opposition parties were unable to register their candidates for the July 30th presidential election. The parties blamed their plight on the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, saying they did not have the official voters' roll from which to find the required 100 signatures of endorsement from registered voters. On Tuesday, the chief election agent of the Movement for Democratic Change Alliance, Jameson Timba, said even though the MDC managed to register, the issue of the voters' roll was still problematic.
It is disgusting. This is totally unacceptable, taking into account that a foreign government is bragging on Twitter that they were given the roll and will not be participating in our elections.
That was a reference to the British Embassy in Harare, which said Monday it had received a copy of the voters' roll from the commission. ZEC chairperson Priscilla Chigumba says her organization is working to ensure all 23 presidential candidates and prospective participants in the July 30th election receive the roll.
Whatever the anomalies are, whatever legal recourse that they have, will not stop the election. I want that to be very clear, and that's the rule. What candidates can do for whatever reason and whatever their opinions and views are is actually use anything that they come up with to challenge the outcome of the election.
Opposition parties say they also want the roll to check for ghost voters. Timba said there will be no election if the commission does not answer the opposition demands.
Continue to put pressure on ZEC to behave themselves. If our demands are not met, there will be no election. ZEC chairperson is not a player in our electoral field. She is a referee. If the players say they are not going to play again, what role will a referee play when there are no players play again?
President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who appointed Chigumba, made a campaign pitch on social media Tuesday.
Takuna umwe angasumudzira chikaye kwedu.
He ended by calling for a peaceful election from which he said all Zimbabweans can prosper. Mnangagwa, who took over after Robert Mugabe resigned under military pressure last November, has vowed to ensure a credible election. But a Harare-based senior researcher for Pretoria's Institute for Security Studies, Derek Matshati, says the Electoral Commission's independence remains doubtful.
It's indicative of the fact that we do not have a truly independent Electoral Commission. So, and that has been a long-standing complaint of the opposition parties. What should have happened is that the President should have approached the Electoral Commission, and the Electoral Commission should have said, no, hold on, we're not ready, we don't have a voters' roll. Please hold back for a few days while we make sure we... But because the Electoral Commission is not independent, it didn't want to challenge the president, it didn't complain about the date set for the nomination court, and the nomination court convened without there being a voters' roll in place. So effectively, those nomination proceedings were legally invalid. And I think that is why the nomination court was set for that date, because the president was aware that the opposition parties hadn't got their act together. They weren't ready for nomination day, and that's precisely what happened. Chaos resulted.
Zimbabwe's High Court has ordered the Electoral Commission to furnish the list of voters to the National Constitutional Assembly Party after Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights petitioned the court. Opposition parties have long accused the ruling ZANU-PF party of manipulating the Elections Commission to ensure victory at the polls. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Tens of thousands of children in Cameroon's English-speaking regions have lost access to education as they are caught in a web of fighting between armed separatists and government troops. Many of the children have fled to the capital to escape the violence in their home regions. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
It is a bright Tuesday morning with children hawking goods to drivers and passers-by on the congested streets of Yaoundé. The number of these sidewalk sellers is increasing as youth flee Cameroon's English-speaking northwest and southwest regions. Among them is 16-year-old Delphine Tabe. She says she has been a hawker for more than a year since she fled from a village in Lebialem, an administrative unit in the southwest.
I am selling boiled groundnut to have money and help my mother, who is in the hospital. She was beaten by Cameroonian gendarmes after a military man was killed in our village. My mother almost died. Our schools were burned and students were beaten. Since that day in May 2017, we escaped to Yaoundé and we do not have money to go to school.
Delphine says her chances of becoming a teacher are gradually slipping away, as she has no one to sponsor her education. Instead, she has to look for money to help her sick mother. At this kitchen in the house where Delphine lives in Yaoundé, food is being prepared for 32 people. Emmanuel Nimbo, a 52-year-old government worker originally from Lebialem, says that a year ago, he had only 5 mouths to feed. The number exploded as people from the southwest fled their villages and pleaded for him to feed and shelter them. Emmanuel says he is praying for the crisis to stop because many have been coming and he can no longer help.
We are stretching an olive hand of peace. Those in the bush should give a chance. Come back home to their homes so that they could meet their mothers, their fathers, brothers and sisters.
Schools have been closed in the northwest and southwest areas since November 2016, when lawyers and teachers began a strike to stop what they see as the overbearing use of French. Separatists took over the movement and began pushing for the regions to become independent. Since then, several dozen schools have been torched, and armed men have kidnapped or killed a number of teachers. Many students in the regions can no longer go to school for fear of the unknown. The United Nations estimates that more than 100,000 people, a majority of them children of school age, have fled the violence in the English-speaking regions to safer localities. Tens of thousands have crossed over to Nigeria, and no one knows when any of them will ever return to school. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, for VOA News, Yaoundé.
18 past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The only Senegal, the only team at the World Cup with an African coach, is on the field now for its tournament opener against Poland. The score so far, Senegal 1, Poland 0. Senegal is hoping for a breakout game from Liverpool's multi-talented Sadio Mane, while Poland is led by Bayern Munich's Robert Lewandowski. Later in the last match of the day, Egypt faces host Russia. Egypt star Mohamed Salah, who has been recovering from a shoulder injury, is expected to be on the field to provide a badly needed boost to its struggling offense after an opening 1-0 loss. Russia, the lowest ranked team in the competition, pounded Saudi Arabia 5-0 in its opener. Japan scored a 2-1 victory over Colombia in the first match of the day. For more details on World Cup activity, stay tuned for the Sunny Side of Sports coming up in just a few minutes. Nigeria's meager electricity output in the face of rapidly growing demand has been a challenge to economic development. Although Nigeria is an oil and gas exporter, both urban and rural communities suffer frequent power failures. Reporter Gift Agiriga from Abuja reports on the problem.
Nigerian businesses and homes experience power failure or voltage fluctuations about 7 times a week, each lasting for about 2 hours or more. The result, damaged electrical equipment, lost output, and even spoiled foods. Consumers are forced to buy transformers, generators, and their own electric poles and wiring to connect to the grid. Sunday Oduton is the Executive Director of Research and Advocacy for the Association of Nigeria Electricity Distributors. He says the biggest cause of outages is corruption.
It might interest you to know that between 1989 and 1999, Nigeria had not less than 4 leaders. In those years, I can confirm to you that money was appropriated and budgeted for power. Not a single power plant was built in those 10 years period. Now, around 2002, the federal government sought to address the emission gap with the National Prepaid Metering Program. That program failed due to corruption, inefficiency, and lack of proper coordination.
Another factor, he says, population growth. In 1960, the population was 45 million. Now, it is 185 million. Infrastructure hasn't kept pace. Oduton says to ensure an uninterrupted power supply, Nigeria needs to quadruple output to about 20,000 megawatts a day. He says the government has embarked on a program to increase power generation, transmission, and distribution. Mostly, it is relying on new gas and hydroelectric plants and fixing damaged fuel pipelines and updating turbines at plants. However, the government last year signed a $20 billion deal to build nuclear power plants over the next few decades with Rosatom, Russia's nuclear power agency. The country now produces between 4,000 and 5,000 megawatts a day, although recent improvements pushed output to a peak of 5,222 a few months ago. Still, Nigerians continue to groan over the erratic power supply and high bills. Hairstylist Ralph Fache says he spends about $13 to $15 a day to buy fuel to run his business.
I make an average of like $25 a day. I spend more money trying to get fuel to run my business. As a matter of fact, it's my biggest nightmare. So whenever there is no light, I feel this expense is coming on.
Other consumers complain about what they say is excessive billing. Most consumers don't have meters to track usage, and the power companies make assumptions on bills that many users say are too high. In 2016, the World Factbook ranked Nigeria 65th in the amount of electricity it produces. While that's in the top half of the economies ranked, it's well below many countries with much smaller populations, such as Australia, which has 23 million people and ranks 20th in power output. For VOA, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
Post-harvest losses threaten food security and livelihoods for many households in sub-Saharan Africa. Estimates from the World Bank show that the annual value of post-harvest losses for grains alone exceeds $4 billion. In Tanzania, where 85% of the population relies on agriculture, domestic food production barely meets national needs. Martin Fischler is the program coordinator in East Africa for Helavita, a Swiss development agency which is helping smallhold farmers in the country's central region increase productivity and improve their income. Ruben Chama asked him about his organization's projects for farmers.
In practical terms, we focus on agriculture production, access to markets for focusing mainly on smallholder farmers, but overall strengthening and developing value chains. We understand ourselves as a facilitator, bringing together different actors and make the market systems work better, specifically for the smallholder farmers.
Could you share with us some of the successful projects that you have initiated in Tanzania?
On the one side is what related to agriculture and markets. That's the Grain Post-Harvest Loss Prevention Project. It's a project we implement since 2013 with funding from the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation, STC. And this has to do with reducing post-harvest losses for small farmers and also bringing in the private sector in supplying improved post-harvest technology. So we consider this, in the meantime, having a track record of 4 or 5 years as a successful project, because farmers increasingly are aware and picking up these technologies to reduce the post-harvest losses, mainly in maize. Other successful projects we have been implementing is in horticulture. We have one project in Singida working with 100 women groups. They produce vegetables, onion, tomatoes and dry leaves, and also process them. We have quite innovatively supported the construction of 3 tomato processing plants at the district level. You know, usually processing units are in capitals, in towns, and then the transport issue, especially like perishable commodity like tomato, it's not easy. So it's better to process it on the spot, and then they can sell and produce with added value, tomato pulp, tomato paste, they even make tomato wine.
How important is the research that you've done in collaboration with the University of Zurich? How important is this to your work?
Of course, we expect the findings to be giving us answers to very relevant questions we have, especially if you take a commodity like maize, the price volatility, the difference between the harvest season and the lean season, there's a lot of questions around how can farmer benefit on the one hand from storing the commodity and sell later at a higher price. That's a benefit of the farmer, but also as such, price volatility, you know, price instability is not good for markets. It creates a lot of dynamics. And then let's say farmers or consumers have to buy at a very high price in the lean season. There's a lot of speculation around. So one would expect that from this research, we have good answers, which help us also to direct the implementation of our projects.
In your view, how can agriculture boost economic development in Africa?
If you take a case like Tanzania, where 80 to 90% of the people are still in agriculture, this is also like if you go back like in history in Europe, you know, today agriculture maybe 2 or 3% of the population is agriculture, but agriculture was the base of economic development and now what is also in Tanzania called industrialization of an economy. So it's very important that there is enough investment in boosting agriculture production and I emphasize processing and creating added value. Sometimes it hurts me to see how, you know, you see mangoes rotting under a tree and then in the next shop you find mango juice imported from South Africa or elsewhere. I mean, why is it not possible that the processing takes place in the country where the raw material is abundantly available?
That was Martin Fischler, East Africa's program coordinator for Helivats, a Swiss development agency, speaking to VOA's Ruben Chama in Kondoa, central Tanzania. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Lennis Rimkus, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll look into the controversial topic of term limits for African leaders. Many heads of state disdain the restriction in order to maintain a grip on power. Term limits versus leaders for life on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com. The news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.
40 greetings to all our VOA listeners. This is Sonny Young, host of The Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me at 1630 and 1830 UTC, Monday through Friday, for special World Cup updates during the month-long football festival in Russia. Right here on The Voice of America.